trying to, anyway, I better not, but made him very discouraged. And we're going to look at that. It's a real problem, amen. If you've lived any amount of time, it's a real problem to face discouragement. And then there's another second level of discouragement, which becomes on the spiritual side as well. It's one thing to get discouraged in your job, get discouraged in your family, things like that. It's another thing to get discouraged with the things of the Lord. And that discouragement comes in there. And I tell you what, Satan really uses that in our life to put a wedge between us and God. Actually, there's an old story about that, Satan was selling off some of his tools. And and obviously, this is a story. And there is a bunch of tools laid out there, and there is one of them that somebody had noticed and had the highest price tag on it. It was the least impressive tool-looking tool there was. And somebody had asked him why it was so expensive, and it was just an awful-looking thing. It was an old splitting wedge. Yeah, it was just all beat up and used. And he said, "Oh, that's the best tool I have." And it said on it, discouragement. He said, "With that tool of discouragement, I have put a wedge between more people and God than anything else." And it's true, isn't it? Because isn't it amazing what we do and discouragement comes to our life? Sometimes we just start blaming God for stuff. Isn't that amazing? I was thankful for we were at a church in Arkansas on Wednesday, and Brother Noel Swinter has preached here a couple times, and we were at their church Wednesday night, and he wasn't preaching. He heard we were coming, and he left town. And the man preaching that night had a wonderful message out of James, and he made a statement there, and about pride and contention and discouragement and dissatisfaction, things like that. I don't think he said discouragement, but dissatisfaction and pride and contention. And he says he said this, and what a great reminder it is. He said, "What are we owed in life? What are we owed?" Anybody have an idea what you are owed in life? O-W-E-D. Anybody? Death and hell. And essentially nothing. We're not owed anything. And he said this. He said, so much of our contention comes because in our pride we think we're owed something. And we're discouraged because we didn't get what we thought we ought to have. Boy, isn't that true? Well, I sat there and meditated. Oh, man, that is so true. Woe is me, right? We do this all the time. And Satan uses discouragement to put a wedge between us and God so often. And sometimes it's just because we don't understand what the Lord is doing. And we look at it as something that He is doing to us and not for us. And sometimes it's hard to see that, right? When we're right in the thick of the fog of war, and it's hard to see, oh, this battle, this is awesome. He's doing this for me. Well, you know, you're just fighting to stay alive at times. And with discouragement, there's probably no greater example than you could find than over in 1 Kings chapter 19. And with the prophet Elijah, played a great role in Israel, and probably one of the most dramatic stories of the Bible. I shouldn't say stories, one of the most dramatic events of the Bible, and his confrontation on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. And Elijah was outnumbered 850-1. Sure, he was, but you know what? A minority with God is a majority, amen? And we see this here in Elijah's life, and we know the events. We've looked at it many times. Here, the group in Sunday school, you know exactly, you've studied this and looked at this before, and there they were on Mount Carmel, and Elijah laid down the ultimatum. Either God is God or Baal is God. They both can't be God, so let's do this. Whichever one answers by fire, that'll be God. They said, okay, fine. And you know what happens. And it finally gets on through the day, and it's Elijah's turn. They've been doing all sorts of stuff throughout that day. Elijah finally gets up at the evening time of the evening sacrifice. Think about how exhausting of a day that was. Don't miss this. Elijah had sat there and watched this demonic activity all day. They have been praying to the god of Baal, who doesn't exist. They're praying to Satan. They're cutting themselves. Blood's gushing. I mean, just... And then what really zaps your energy is when you're mocking somebody. He said, well, hey, why are you... That was a joke. Maybe cry louder, right? Maybe Baal is on a trip. Maybe he's gone on a long journey. He can't hear you, and you know, so he's just mocking him the whole time, right? But by the end of the day, the evening sacrifice, you know what happens? He prays, lightning comes down, obliterates everything. Prophets of Baal go, "Whoa, he's God. The Lord, he is God, right? Jehovah, he's God. He's God." And he's like, "You're exactly right." And of course, he leads them down to the brook and hacks her head off. And what a story that is, you know. And it got back to Jezebel. And you know what? How she responded to that, right? You always have to be careful of reading too much in between the lines, but there are definitely some indications of Ahab, who was a Jew, and he knew the law, and he knew he was wrong, and he knew he knows this. And I think he went back to Jezebel with a little bit of excitement, because he was like pumped too. He's like, whoa. He just watched the God, he's a Jew, his God, wipe out these prophets of Baal and take up the lightning that came down, the fire that came down. He just saw it too, and he went back. I think he was just telling Jezebel, like, "You wouldn't believe what happened. You know, it was awesome. You know how guys are. You know, it was awesome." And she's sitting there just like seething. He killed who? You know, the prophets of Baal. What? And so, you know what happens? The edict goes out. The words go out from Jezebel. Elijah's a dead man. Right? I'm going to do more to him, you know, than he has done to the gods or whatever. And what we had here, really, with Elijah and Jezebel and the events here that we know so well, is really, it is a perfect storm. It is a perfect recipe for discouragement. It really is. And so often Satan wields this weapon of discouragement when we're the most easily susceptible to it. Can I remind you? Satan is a weasel. Amen. He's been studying us for 6,000 years. He knows us better than we do. Think about how dumb we are. He's been using the same thing since the beginning of time, and we still fall for it. Right? We're not real bright folks. Right? And so, but he knows when we're weak. He knows when we're susceptible. He knows when we're discouraged. He knows when we're physically exhausted. He knows when we're afraid and have fear that come into our life. And that, I mean, I'm telling you, it just creates us the perfect storm. And if we would watch those patterns in our life, right, we would know how to combat discouragement when it comes into our life. Because we could say, "Oh, that was Satan," right? I was telling Miss Sherry this morning, I remember Lester Olof telling about a time when he was down in Chattanooga. He'd gotten super sick, ended up in the hospital down in Chattanooga, and he said while he was there in the hospital, I mean, just all these things kept coming to his mind about, you know, kind of he's going to die, he's a failure, you know, he might as well just quit, you know, he can't keep doing this, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, just words of discouragement are, you know, you've been there, right? Just laying there in your bed thinking about everything negative and wrong and everything bad in your life. And he said this, he goes, "When I figured out who was doing the talking," right? He said, "I told him to go home." He said, "That was a nice way to tell him to go somewhere." And he said, "I got up and I was back in the fight," right? Discouragement. Yeah, it happens to some of the greatest. We look at some of the servants of God, and listen, they're of like passion as we are, like the Bible said about Elijah. He is just like us. We are just like them. But we look at some of the great servants of God, and you know what? You find out they deal with discouragement and disappointment as well. They succumb to it at times as well. It gets really bad. So there's a recipe here for discouragement. There are several recipes for discouragement. Let me give you four of them, and then we'll look at them. Here's the recipes. Here's four of them. After great victory, during a time of physical exhaustion, during times of loneliness. And listen, you can be lonely in a crowd of people. During times of loneliness, and here's the other one, the last one, an inaccurate view of circumstances. When you're looking at your circumstances all wrong, It's an avenue. It's a recipe for discouragement. So there's a backstory to Elijah's and the bout that he had with discouragement. 3.5 years before this event on Mount Carmel, if you'll remember, he had told King Ahab that the Lord was sending a drought to punish Ahab for his idolatry. Why would God punish somebody who is not a Jew and who doesn't know the law and doesn't know about idolatry? I'm telling you, Ahab knew everything he was doing was wrong. And Elijah even told him to his face, your idolatry, because of your idolatry, Israel is going to suffer because of your idolatry, and drought is coming. It's not going to rain for 3 years and 3.5 years. And so the brook dried up. Remember that? God sent Elijah. He is fed by the brook Cherith. A raven comes and feeds him every day. Eventually that brook dries up, and he goes from there, and he goes to stay with this widow and her son. And he's staying in Jezebel's home country. This is kind of interesting when you think about it. And this widow's taking care of him. And he miraculously, because they're taking care of the man of God, they get taken care of for the rest of the period of this drought. But finally, God is preparing him for the time when the rain is going to come again. So Elijah's in a waiting period. From the time that he told Ahab, you are going to experience a drought because of your sin and because of your wickedness. And from there, Ahab even had threatened to kill Elijah. So Elijah got out of there. He's by the brook. He's with the widow woman and her son. But time is up. The drought is over. And it's time for him to come to Ahab and deal with what's been going on. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go, show thyself unto Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. 3 years. Not 3.5. I don't know why I said 3.5. Yep. I'm confusing the 3.5 years split of the tribulation. I've been looking at that a lot lately, and things get jumbled up in my head. 3 years. And Elijah went to show himself unto Ahab, and there was a sore famine in Samaria. And Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. For it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said unto Obadiah, go into the land unto all the fountains of water and unto all the brooks. Peradventure we may find grass to save the horses and mules alive, that we lose not all the beasts. So they divided the land between them to pass throughout. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. And as Obadiah was in the way, behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him, and fell on his face and said, art thou that my Lord Elijah? Now Elijah's been in hiding for 3 years. Nobody's seen this prophet for 3 years. And Obadiah runs into him, right? And he said, I am. Go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah's here. And Obadiah's like, I'm not telling him you're here. He'll kill me. Right? We don't understand the whole dynamics of this type of rulership and leadership in a country with a king. And so, as God said in verse 1, show thyself unto Ahab, here in verse 1, the 3 years that Elijah had spent in the wilderness were about to come together now with this standoff between the prophets of Baal and God. And so we know this, right? Most good things don't come easily or quickly, do they? Right? People say, people are sometimes concerned about how hard something is. But we know that anything of any value doesn't come easy. Yeah. If things of value came easy, then they wouldn't be valuable anymore. Everybody would be doing them, right? And so any long-term efforts working to, say, strengthen a marriage or to build a Sunday school class or to rear children or to solve relationship problems, what is it about them? They all take time. They just take time. Some things aren't fixed overnight. And what happens is when we don't see immediate results, We can feel like our effort is a waste. I tell you what, one of the biggest struggles I have had, one of the biggest battles I have had in ministry is that I came in later, but before ministry, the thrust of my livelihood was selling a product, producing a product, seeing it come to fruition and getting paid and going on. Really short windows of accomplishment. I mean, most everything I did would start from a concept, or somebody would email a drawing, somebody would email you a design, somebody would email you just a thumbnail, a little sketch of an idea, and within weeks or maybe a few months, it's done. And you go on and you're working on something else and things like that. Can I tell you, ministry is not like that. You talk about banging my head up against the wall. I'm not used to this. I wasn't used to this. I'm thinking, well, you preach and people come. Well, you preach and people get right with God. You preach and people get saved. Nope. No. Doesn't happen. Yeah. But you know what I'm assured of? When I would take a contract and the signatures on the contract would say, I'm going to get paid. Yeah. You're going to get paid. When? Maybe 6 months. Probably not. Usually 30 days after a project's completed, you're going to get paid. You know what I realized most of in the ministry is? You get paid. Not in this life. Yeah. You know what you have to do? You have to trust God. You're going to see it one day. You have no idea. Not just me, you included. You have no idea when you get to heaven who is going to come up to you and hug your neck and thank you for giving them the gospel. You may have no idea. The track you passed out, somewhere down the line, somebody read it, and they put their faith in Jesus, and you're going to meet Him one of these days. And you talk about a rejoicing, right? Listen, it's one of the biggest struggles of discouragement, looking for the results now. Can I tell you, we're living in a now society, aren't we? Walmart, the shelves of our stores are full, right? And we go in right now, and not only right now, we go in right now with no risk. No risk. Oh, I don't like it. Bring it back. Why? You know what? They don't even remember the day when they'd say, well, what's wrong with it? Why are you bringing it back? Did you use it? I mean, 20 questions you had to pass before they'd like begrudgingly go, give you your money back, right? They didn't want to take it back. Now it's like, they're just chucking stuff behind them and just giving you your stuff. They don't care, right? What does that mean? No risk. So we live in a generation that is right now immediate gratification and no risk around it. And God is still telling us to live by faith and to trust Him, right? And we endeavor to achieve things in our life and to fix things in our life and to build things for God, and they just don't come to fruition quickly. And sometimes it just is really, it really sets up a time for us to, when we don't see immediate results, it can feel like our labors are a waste. They're a waste. And you know what Satan sees when he sees that? Perfect opportunity. Just give up. It would be a good time to bow out. Whatever is going on here, it's not working anyway. Maybe somebody else will make it work better. Maybe somebody else will do it. Somebody better, more accomplished, more experienced, right? Yeah. Oh, Satan loves doing that. Yeah, don't just back off talking to your friend. Obviously, after this much time, it's not working. And probably just making it worse now. Now you're just making it worse. Oh, Satan comes in with all sorts of stuff, right? You know what? Hey, listen. You know what happened when the Lord came in and would say, yeah, why don't you back off for a while? You know what comes from that? Joy, because you know it's of the Lord. But when discouragement and defeat comes along, you think, yeah, you're probably right. That's not God. That's Satan. He's just taking that wedge and hammered it in between you and God, right? And we need to discern that. We need to be able to see what is discouragement. We need to be able to see what may be of God. And so after meeting with Ahab, Elijah, and the prophets, here they are. We know what happened. They're up there at Mount Carmel. And it was an incredible thing to watch what God did. And God did immediately answer by fire there. I mean, that was a pretty immediate. And at times, obviously, God does do that. The people are screaming out, the Lord is God. The Lord is God is a wonderful thing. Look at verse 39 of chapter 18. You can see it for yourself. I know you're familiar with it, But let's just read it anyway. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, chapter 18, verse 39. They fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord," that's Jehovah, capital L-O-R-D, Jehovah. "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And it was an incredible victory. God was vindicated. Right? God was vindicated over the 3 years of drought. God was vindicated over the challenge that Elijah made of, and what a challenge that was. Let's see who's God that answers by fire. Boy, that's stepping out on a limb. Could you imagine? Right? Would you do that on visitation? Let's see if God answers by fire on your home, and let's see who's God, you know? And poof, you know, we wouldn't, that'd be foolish. We wouldn't say a thing like that, would we? And pretty incredible, pretty dramatic. Right. But why would he become so easily discouraged after that? I mean, it's a pretty big deal. How has anybody ever seen God rain fire down from heaven on something after you immediately prayed? No, they're still alive, aren't they? They're walking among you. No, you have prayed. No, I'm true. No, we've never seen it. Could you imagine? Sometimes we look at these events and we go, "Wow, how could they doubt that?" Have you ever seen a sea parted and walked through? Right. I've never even seen something as insignificant as the James River stopped up. I mean, in the summertime, I've seen it pretty low, but I've not watched it heaped up on piles and just kind of trot across to 10 feet across or whatever, 20 feet across there. I've never seen that. Never seen the lake parted. That would be a lot easier than the James River, than the Jordan River, similar, different continents, than the Jordan River, right, in the time of harvest when it's up to a mile wide, right? Or the Red Sea. But wait, they still came out of the most dramatic and sensational acts of God. Within a few steps outside of it, doubt came again and discouragement. Yeah. It happens, doesn't it? Absolutely does. And you would think that victory, we would look back and it would sustain us through the dark times. But it doesn't. Why? Because, you know, it's hard to stay on an emotional high for a long period of time. Yeah. If we've seen anything wonderful, anything great happen, there is usually always a little neutral letdown afterward. Some call it the buyer's remorse. I bought something this week and I thought, "Oh, I shouldn't have. Why did I do that?" And in the long term, it was actually a very wise purchase. But small Dutch part of me is like, "Oh, don't do that. You just spent money," right? And the frivolous other whatever nationality part of me was not frivolous, but anyway. No, it's normal. You have a neutral letdown after some great thing that you see. And I see it here in a church, you know. I see it as a pastor and those that have been pastors before that have been through this church, they'll all tell you the same thing. Pastor friends of mine, they'll tell you the same thing. "Hey, listen, we got Friend Day coming up next week, right? And we're going to push. And we'll have a great day and we'll have visitors. And we're just praying that we can have those that are lost be here. And we'll be able to preach the gospel and some will get saved. And listen, it'll be a great, great high day." But then Monday will come and we'll go, "Oh." It happens. It absolutely happens. And we can't prevent the downtime. We can't prevent that. That's almost a natural thing that happens. We can't do that. But what we can do is be aware of it so it doesn't drag us into discouragement. Right? Because once we get to the place of discouragement, Satan will start pounding that wedge in. So not only during times of great victory like we saw here with Elijah, but also in times of physical exhaustion. Have you ever had a project that was ahead of you that had a deadline? And it was like, I mean, Audra used to live in that. I used to hear about it all the time, about payroll and this and that. You were working like 6,000 hours a day. They were. It was a lot. It was maybe 5,000, not 6,000. But I don't want to exaggerate. And but you might have had a goal. And you get to, I mean, you're just exhausted. I mean, things are bothering you. And really, in the back of your mind, you're like, "Why is this bothering me?" Well, you're exhausted. You're physically, I mean, I'm telling you, we are body, soul, and spirit. They are all connected. They're all connected. When your physical is drained, it affects the spiritual side of you. It really does. Here's my example. You've heard me give it to you before, haven't you? It's been a few years, but I'll tell you this. Get super sick, go to the hospital, and have somebody bring your Bible and see if you open it and read it. When you're really sick, you can't think. You can't process sometimes. I'm not talking you got a cold and you got your Bible. I mean, when you're sick, when your body is totally drained, it is hard to focus on. You're just like laying there, like, you know, and you feel like a heathen. Like, I can't even read right now. You know why? I can't even process. Why? You're so exhausted, right? It's why it's important. It's important for us to keep our body in a good physical condition. It'll help you with discouragement. It'll help your spiritual side too. Yep. And so this was another ingredient of Elijah's discouragement was fatigue. Fatigue. Listen to what Vince Lombardi said, one of the greatest coaches. Listen to what he said. Fatigue makes cowards of all of us. Fatigue makes cowards of all of us. That's some of the military training, isn't it, Brother Chuck? They get you in total fatigue. Some of those guys in the upper end and the special forces, they'll keep them up for 2 to 3 days at a time. Absolutely. And then train them to be able to operate in extreme fatigue. Why? Because really, realistically, you're the most vulnerable then. And you got to learn, these guys have to learn mentally work through that. Even though the body is screaming that you need to sleep, right? You got some guy screaming at you to go on. But listen, in the midst of war, you don't get to take a nap, right? It's not like, okay, hold on, time out. You know, bombs and missiles stop, the mats come out, everybody has nap time, right? Like kindergarten, and then somebody rings the bell, okay, we're ready, you know. That'd be awesome, huh? Wars would last forever then, my goodness, everybody'd be ready to go. Yeah. Fatigue. It was the Scottish preacher Robert Murray McShane, who many say literally worked himself to an early grave. 29 years old, he died. Completely exhausted because he never stopped. He said on his deathbed, "God gave me a message to deliver and a horse to ride. Now I've killed the horse and I cannot deliver the message." He rode it right into the ground. Yeah. You know what he did forget? And all of his zeal, right? But it was some zeal, but not according to knowledge. Jesus told his own disciples, come apart and rest. You have to. You have to. It's one of the things I'm terrible at. And because there's always so much to do. And some of these older preachers, I've had a few of them tell me, you got to stop. You got to stop. It's like, but there's still so much to do because it's like, you know, when you're spinning your wheels sometimes, it feels like you got more to do. And they say, you got to stop. A friend of mine, a few towns over, from us. He said, after 27 years, I finally told my church, nope, I'm changing stuff. And he takes time off. He takes days off. He does, you know. And he said, I was running myself into the ground. And it's normal. It's a normal thing to do. A lot of people do that. But you know what? It's not good. And what happens when you get into the place of fatigue, right? You've created the perfect recipe for discouragement to come in, to get discouraged. And you've got to watch your body. You absolutely do. Yeah. Remember in Mark 6:31 that I just quoted to you when Jesus told them to come apart and rest? Do you remember this? That immediately after that statement, the multitudes came to hear Jesus. And they didn't really get to rest right then. It was busy, busy, busy. But we saw a really important principle there. And they did have to rest, and they did have to get apart. Elijah here in our text is absolutely, completely exhausted, right? He's been 3 years of a drought. 3 years, part of it living by some brook and hiding, getting fed by a raven. I don't know how much food a raven brings. I doubt they're dropping a whole half of beef on you. That'd be kind of nice, huh? I doubt, you know, dropping a hole. Here comes this, you know, and yeah, great. I don't think a raven, I mean, he's not eating much probably. A little bit, just necessity. Alan's like, I don't know. How do I know what a raven can bring? Right? He's been with this widow woman and her son. had just enough to, I mean, they just lived. They lived, right? And then this whole thing with the prophets of Baal, I mean, that was exhausting all day long. Exhaustion sinks in. And during the times of physical exhaustion is when Elijah had found himself discouraged. Discouraged. Yeah. Look at chapter 19, look at verse 2. I'm going to show you this. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Some have said, and one has said that I have read after, that this may have been an empty threat, right? Some people have surmised that, okay, if she's going to kill him, she could have just gone out and killed him. Why warn him? She didn't warn Naboth. She just dragged him out, got a bunch of liars, put him before court, and killed him so Ahab could have that vineyard. But she put out the threat. She put out the word, right? Ahab had put out a threat before too, which caused him to run, you know. But God told him to get by the brook. He didn't just take off. God told him where to go, right? But Jezebel here, she put out this threat. And so here he is running again. He's come off great victory. He's come out of great exhaustion, right? I mean, the perfect storm is setting up for the discouragement to come. And here he is running. He's running away. Not only during times of great victory, not only during times of great exhaustion, but also during times of loneliness. We're very susceptible during times of loneliness. Jezebel's threat worked. Elijah took off. Now he's all by himself. Just running away. All by himself. He has nobody who could encourage him. He has nobody who could, you know, just give him a, no, you'll be fine. You know, she's not, blah, 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 whatever. God just did this, like he's going to let you die now, right? Kind of like when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea and they got out into the wilderness, right? It's like, well, God's just going to bring you out to the wilderness now after this great thing to die? No. Hey, listen, we can do it right here, right? I mean, we have watched God work to get us to this land and this location and this place and this town. And it seems like the wheels start churning pretty slow again. And you're going, okay, what's going on? Right? You can get discouraged. Yeah. You know, you got to remind yourself, God didn't bring us out here to die. I mean, what kind of a testimony would that be anyway? Could you imagine? Here we are. Look what God did. It's gone. Oh, my goodness. No, absolutely not. And you got to be careful. Be careful. Times of loneliness. Times of loneliness. And even in nature, if you look at it, lone animals are some of the most, they are the most vulnerable out of there, especially if they're pack animals, when they're weak, when they're stragglers, when they're left behind. That's why Jesus was so important, you know, the illustration of the shepherd going to get that one out of the 90 and nine. You know why? Because they get away from the flock and they're vulnerable. Hey, listen, don't get away from church. Don't get away from assembly. Don't get away from fellowship with believers. Well, I got all my friends at work now. Careful. You're straggling. They can't help you. They'll actually encourage you to discouragement. They absolutely will. And it's times of loneliness that we got to be careful, that we have got to be aware. 1 Peter 5:8, we know this, but he said, be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. He's actually waiting on us. He just sits and watches and plots. Yeah. Salivates. Creeps in closer and closer and closer. And here we are like dumb sheep, you know, eating here and eating there, and right? Walking over here, and the pack goes over here. Before we know it, we're chomping on something over here that we shouldn't be, and all of a sudden you look up and it's looking at you. No. Then you're dead. Yeah. Loneliness. Loneliness. Finally, let me just stop with this. We've got two more points to hit. We won't get to them all today because we're just on point number one. Right? Victory, exhaustion, loneliness, and then finally an and a wrong view of circumstances. A wrong view of circumstances. Have you ever looked at circumstances in your life and you came to this certain conclusion? This is going to happen, right? And it's like, it didn't, right? Remember that statistic, 85% of the things that we worry about never come to pass? That is statistically accurate, they say. I don't know who they is, but I can see in my own life. You could probably see in yours. That's probably a pretty close number, right? Probably is. In verse 4, look what Elijah says. It's enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers. What a statement. Yeah. Have you ever looked at scenarios in your life and situations in your life, and maybe you didn't grow up where your parents grew up. Maybe God saved you, and He did. You're here. I know those here today that have been born again. God has saved you, and your parents maybe never did come to Christ, or maybe they didn't come until later in life, and they didn't have the same testimony that you have. And maybe you come into a situation in your life, a down place in your life, a dark time in your life, and you thought, well, I guess I'm no better than they are. I thought I was going to do more. Looks like I'm not. This is where Elijah is. He says, I'm no better than my fathers. Why would he say that? Well, he's a prophet of God. This guy has called down fire from heaven. This guy has seen that was Elisha. I'm confusing him here. But he has seen the miracles of God like you wouldn't believe. And then he says, I'm no better than my dad. No better than my granddad. No better than my great-great-grandfather. Nothing different about me. He's looking at his circumstances and where he is. And now discouragement is just putting a wedge between him and God. Yeah. And we do it, don't we? Discouragement will blind us. Watch, it'll blind us to the reality of what's happening around us. We'll look at the circumstances with a blinder on, right? And we can't really see. And then we come up in our own mind of what's going on. Watch, and what is always going on in our mind is filtered through discouragement. We have discouragement-colored glasses, right? And everything's dark, and everything's dreary, and everything's like rainy. And there's always water on those glasses from the rain. And it's just like, meh. Yeah, I'm going to go eat dirt, right? Yeah. So what do? Here's one of the cures to defeating discouragement. It's biblical. It's called right thinking. Biblical thinking. You want to get out of the fog of discouragement that you might be in today? Think biblically. What's one thing we need to do? Well, here we go. Philippians 4:8. You could probably quote this, couldn't you? Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of a good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Think on these things. Hey, listen, if the things coming into your mind, if the discouraging things coming into your mind are things that are not true, or they're things that aren't honest, or things that aren't just, they're not pure, they're not lovely, they're not of a good report, they're not of virtue, they're not of praise, stop thinking about them. You say, well, I can't. Well, I'm going to show you can, all right? Watch this. You ready? Think of an elephant. Now a cat. Think of a dog. Think of a car. Think of a Pekingese. You're like, I don't even know what that looks like. Okay, think of a dog. Think of a building. Do you realize every time I say something, you went to think of something different? Well, you know what it shows? You can. You can change your thinking. Well, just on anything? No. Change your thinking to things that are true and honest and are lovely and of a good report and virtue and praise. Just change your thinking. I had a relative of mine, we've got to stop here, but it's in the right thinking that helps us get out of the discouragement. Biblical thinking. I have a relative who spent time in special forces in a certain branch of the Navy, and he has seen a lot of things over his 20 years, a lot of awful stuff. He said to this day, if I even see a bug, like a roach that's suffering. I can't watch it suffer because he's watched humans suffer and die, right? And he's like, I got to smash. I can't handle it. I just can't handle it. Too much comes to my mind. But he said this one day. He goes, you know, I don't know. He goes, he doesn't really totally agree with the PTSD stuff. He goes, obviously something's happening there, but you know, he goes, and he said this. I might be weird. I don't know. But he goes, I just have chosen not to think about things. And he doesn't struggle with the, sure, things come to his mind. How can they not? But he has chosen to stop thinking about them and think about something else. I said, well, actually, that's quite biblical. Paul said, forgetting those things which are behind me, right, I press on. One of the great things, great ways out of discouragement is, number one, be aware of what causes it. Be aware of where you are. And number two, change your thinking, right? Quit looking at the circumstances in a wrong, in an unbiblical way. And change your thinking. We're going to look at more of this next week. And may God give us victory in discouragement. Father, thank you today for this. I pray for your encouragement today. And we thank you that, as David said, he encouraged himself in the Lord. And I'm thankful that we can encourage ourselves in you today. And we can live on the victory side. We thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. See you in a minute.